I heard someone at the end of the hall. It was a familiar voice. I picked up my hat and opened the door as he continued.
An undercover means you don't leave the handle of that goddamn Remington sawed-off scattergun hanging out of the shopping bag for every Tom's, Dick, and convict to see.
Vic was already there when I got to them.
Lucian, what are you doing here? This the way you run a stakeout, with Peckerhead here advertising the whole show?
Peckerhead was the descriptive term Lucian used equally for plants, animals, and inanimate objects.
Lucian, I come up here to see how this pissant operation was going, and from what I can see, it ain't.
I pushed my hat back and sighed. You were supposed to stay with Isaac.
Christ, he snores loud enough to wake the dead. I locked the door when I left.
I looked back at Vic, who was smiling and folding her arms over her breasts, the way she always did when Lucian was around. The Ferg continued to look at the floor. The old sheriff wasn't going to go back willingly, and I couldn't leave him out in the open to abuse the staff and draw attention to himself.
"Dark as the inside of a cow in here," he sniffed. "Smells funny."
"It's a supply closet." I heard him rustling around and smelled the tobacco pouch he had just unzipped. "Don't even think about loading up that pipe and smoking it." He continued,
"Trying to improve the environment.
And Leo Gaskell will smell it from halfway down the hallway." He zipped up the beaded pouch for now.
"Who the hell is this Gaskell person anyway? Please keep your voice down."
I leaned my shoulder against the door jamb and tried to find a comfortable position. "We're pretty sure he's the one that tried to drown you in your bathtub." I let that one settle in for a while. He didn't say anything. "Leo Gaskell may be related to Ellen Run's horse. That name mean anything to you?" He still didn't say anything, so I turned around and looked at him. "Maybe Ellen walks over ice?" He was sitting with his real leg propped up over the fake one, staring at the tobacco pouch and pipe sitting in his lap.
"Yep. And his sister.
Did you know she had a kid with Charlie Nerburn?"
"Yep. I was a deputy, for Christ's sake."
"Is there anything else you'd like to tell me, while we're on the subject?" He exhaled deeply.
"Kid's dead."
I continued watching him in a thin strip of light from the partially open door. "Charlie Nerburn's illegitimate son died?"
"Yep."
"How do you know that?"
"She told me."
"Ellen Run's horse?" He nodded, but didn't look up. Sizer Vittoria couldn't find any reference to Ellen Wolksover Ice or any children at the courthouse.
"It was an illegitimate half-breed kid born and died of cholera in Acme in 1950. And you think there were going to be certificates?"
He snorted and stuffed his pipe full. I decided to let him smoke. Maybe it might occupy his mouth. "I'm working on a motive, and I was trying to put together a connection between Leo Gaskell and the Barogias. But if Charlie and Ellen's kid died, then there isn't any way to connect the two. I was working under the assumption that Leo might be the grandson, since he had one of Charlie Nerburn's pistols." He lit the pipe, and I had to admit that it smelled better. I watched him in the half-light, the smoldering embers of the pipe glowing red in the dark closet.
"Lucian, where did you bury Charlie Nerburn?"
A second passed.
"You're just not going to let that go, huh?"
"I think Leo Gaskell may have found him." He was silent for a moment.
"You're shitting me."
He chewed on that one for quite a while. His dark eyes blinked. He took the pipe from his mouth and pointed with the stem across the hall.
"Who you got in the room?"
"Henry Standing Bear."
"Well, hell. If he gets in there, old ladies will cut him from cock to crown with a dull deer antler and save the taxpayers some money."
Lucian had a way with Indian names that was nothing short of creative. I started to respond, but the air caught in my throat for a second, and we both remained absolutely still. There were voices at the end of the hall. This time they came from Cesar Vittoria's direction, and they were growing louder. I had forgotten that the door opened to the inside of the closet, and two sheriffs with a collective three legs trying to get out offered a variety of excitement. Once we finally made it, I could see Vic talking to a man whom they had against the wall beside the stairwell door. Santiago had the man's arm in a reverse wrist lock high at the middle of his back, with his feet pulled out and spread so that his weight was against the partition. Vic had holstered her Glock, and it looked as if she was trying to keep from smiling. As Lucian followed me down the hallway, I noticed a potted poinsettia and a card lying on the floor and scooped them up. I stopped a couple of yards away and called off the armada. "Let him go." Sancho did, and Vic stepped behind Cesar Vittoria so that he couldn't see that she was trying not to laugh out loud. "Joe, what the hell are you doing here?" He cleared his throat and gestured to the card and plastic-wrapped flowers I held. "We were just glad that Anna was all right, and we all chipped in." He glanced around again and then over to Cesar Vittoria's empty wheelchair. "Do you mind if I sit down? I think I might be having a little trouble." Santiago holstered his weapon and held the chair as Joe sat. I thought he might be having a heart attack, but then noticed the dark spot on Joe's pants. I glanced over to Vic, and she nodded, knowing I would want to speak with Santiago. I looked back down to Joe. "How about we get you to the bathroom? Then we can talk." He folded his hands across his lap and nodded, his face pale and his hands trembling. "That would be good." I watched as Vic wheeled the poor man down the hall toward the bathrooms near the nurse's station and turned to the Ferg, Lucian, and Cesar Vittoria. "What happened?"
"He came out of the stairwell and I spoke to him, but he didn't stop, so I bumped him and he started yelling like a madman."
"Great." I glanced to the elder statesman. "What are you smiling about?" Lucian responded, "Of course."
"Well, as incapable as this outfit may look, we're still able to scare the piss out of the local gentry."
I shook my head, turned, and made my way back down the hallway to Henry's room. He was at the door when I got there with the handle of the tomahawk palmed against his forearm as he leaned against the opening. I noticed that the surface of the thing absorbed light. He seemed perfectly relaxed.
"False alarm?"
I was about to speak when the walkie-talkie at my belt began to vibrate. Chapter 13. I jerked my head up and looked down the hall at Ferg and Cesar Vittoria as they stared from their belts to me. I searched in the other direction, but Vic had disappeared around the corner. When I got back to Henry, all he said before shutting the door in my face was, "Go." "Santiago, throw the blanket over your shoulders and stay there till Vic gets back with the wheelchair. Lucian, get in the closet, and Ferg, come with me." I charged down the hall and almost collided with Vic and the wheelchair as I turned the corner at the nurse's station. "You vibrate?"
"Yeah, and it was very exciting."
"Where's Joe Lesky?" She was already past me and had forced Ferg to sidestep in the hallway to escape being run over.
"First stalled in the men's room. I told him that if he stirred, I'd kneecap him."
I glanced over at the Ferg, who shrugged. "Sounds like the perimeter is secure." I pointed to his previous spot on the bench. "Sit." He smiled and hurried by as I went for the supply closet and ran the door into Lucian, who had already manned his post.
"Jesus H. Christ! Damn it, Lucian, move over!" "I am over."
I squeezed past the door and sat on half my chair.
"Shh! I ain't the one talking, goddammit!"
I turned and gave him the proverbial dirty look. It was quiet in the hallway, so Vic must have stayed with Cesar Vittoria. I could hear the hospital heating system and Lucian's aggravated breathing, which had subsided into a regular pattern. I waited and strained my ears, but there was nothing to hear. I went back over the plan and ran through the usual litany of doubts. What were the chances that Leo Gaskell would come straight to the room? Would he be smart enough to check the clipboard we had casually left on the counter at the nurse's station with Anna Walks Over Ice's name listed for room 216? Or had he asked Ruby what room Anna was in? If he did, there would be an older gentleman seated in one of the hallway chairs with a shopping bag between his legs, seemingly falling asleep. At the end of the hall would be a small, dark-haired general practitioner assisting a patient to his room, and, if he looked close enough, a supply closet door barely ajar. I waited 20 minutes, and then started thinking about my options. I could continue to wait, or I could blow the whole operation and go do a little clear and hold. For some reason, Leo had decided to take his time, and for my money,
That made him infinitely more dangerous. Leo was developing tactics. He owed the state at least 2 lives. I doubted he was keeping score. That was okay. I was. Lucian had fallen asleep. I stood and he stirred. Why? I smiled at my old mentor as he craned his wrinkled neck, the one I had thought of wringing on and off for quite some time. Nothing, I'm going out for a little walk. He watched me and nodded. Lasted longer than I would have. Praise from Caesar. You want a gun? Silly question. He put a hand out as I unsnapped the .45 and handed it to him. You got one in the pipe. What are you going to use, harsh language? I glanced out the crack in the doorway. I'll get the shotgun from Ferg. I looked back into the darkness at the old sheriff and my gun. Don't shoot me if I come back. It was blinding in the hallway, but it felt good to stretch my back. I looked down the hall at Vic and Sizer Vittoria. They looked competent and questioning as I held a finger to my lips. I pointed at them and looped a forefinger and thumb into an okay. They nodded, and I stepped across the hall. I knocked twice and opened the door a little. I waited a second, then spoke into the black. Henry?
What are you doing?
It was a scolding tone. I've got a feeling.
Oh, goody.
There was a deep sigh. I closed the door and started for Ferg's position. He checked in both directions as I stopped just short of the intersecting corridor. I took a look for myself, stepped across, and knelt down beside him. Got your sidearm?
Yeah.
Cock it and put it in the bag. I'm going to borrow your shotgun.
Going hunting?
Yep.
What do you want to do about Joe Lesky?
I glanced over in the direction of the bathroom. He made any noise?
Not a peep.
You reckon Vic gave him a heart attack?
She does me.
As I checked the short-barreled shotgun, the Ferg went over to the bathroom door and reassured Joe. When he came back, I slipped down the opposite direction and checked the only other wing on the second floor. There were no doors ajar, so unless I was going to do a room-to-room search, all that was left was the stairwell at the end of this hallway. There were heavy metal doors with thick, wire-reinforced windows set on a diagonal. I peered through as I passed, casually swung the door open, and held the shotgun ready. Nobody. I could go down and check the short entryway that led to the elevators, or I could continue from here to the first floor. The entry corridor would have been easily visible from Ferg's location, so I decided to drop down through the stairwell. I eased the door shut and glanced through the 4 runs of stairs to the concrete floor of the basement below. I hated basements. When I got to the first floor, there was a set of tracks leading down the steps. I placed my foot next to the prints and knelt down to look at them. The prints were of a different brand than the ones that had been left in the snow at the home, but they were larger than mine. Different shoes, but it was the same foot. I decided to forego the conversation with Ruby that I had planned and continued down the stairs to the next security door, which was labeled in large red letters, Hospital Personnel Only. I eased open the heavy door and looked down the corridor toward a steel screen-encaged bulb that hung about halfway down and that gave off a weak, yellowish light. The footprints feathered away on the smooth sheen of the chemically coated concrete, and my only clue abandoned me. I quietly closed the stairwell door and moved along the wall to the first door on the right. I reached across and turned the knob. Locked. I glanced into the darkness between the next bulb and myself, another 20 feet away. The second door was on my side and an equal distance from the first. I moved along the wall and tried the knob. It was stiff, but turned and opened. I glanced in, but the room was dark. I felt along the wall and flipped a switch. It was a storage room with cut-down trays and medical cabinets. There were sterile dressings, bandages, and utility carts, but no Leo Gaskell. So I flipped off the light and quietly closed the door. I thought I might have heard a noise, but I couldn't be sure. I stood there for a moment, listening to the constant thrum of the building as it continued to go about its business of life and death. Join the club. The next door was locked as well, but I could see from here where the hallways joined at the center, just as they did on the two main floors. There were large pipes sticking from the wall that returned and disappeared into the concrete, and there was a little more light coming from the adjoining hallway. An old metal desk, crowded with papers and folders, was shoved against the wall. There was a chair kicked out to the side, and a faint set of boot prints, where whoever had come down the stairwell had sat and waited. Waited for what? Waited for whom? It had been a while since I'd checked in, so I plucked the walkie-talkie from my belt. It was a calculated move, but I felt pretty sure about it. I switched the transceiver to silent, so the only indicator would be the LED gain that hopefully one of my staff would notice. I hit the button. I hit the button again, clicking it off and on. Still nothing. I hit it one more time and got a response. "Where the fuck are you?" Good thing I had turned the volume down. "See anything?" "Footprints." "You?" "Nothing." "Do you need backup?"
"No."
It was silent for a moment. "You suck." The bottom drawer on the right-hand side was slightly ajar. I stooped and pulled out an impressive ring of keys, each one numbered and color-coded with small plastic edges indicating the floor and wing of each. Why would someone leave an entire set of master keys in an unlocked drawer in the basement? I quickly flipped through the sequential numbers to Anna's supposed room, each key clicking like an abacus. Key number 216 was missing. I entertained a dark series of thoughts as ice water flooded my bowels, and I turned the keys to the 100 series and found that key 132 was also gone. The initial response must have been that my left hand pulled the foregrip back, moving the action bar and bolt assembly of the Remington Model 870 back into a cocked position. This same hand must have then come forward as I dropped the keys and slammed a plastic shell with slightly imperfect and deformed buckshot into the action and locked it for fire. Then my right forefinger must have punched the safety through the mechanism, because it didn't fire as I lurched forward, pushed the desk back, and ran into the darkness. I must have chosen the far passageway, because it would give me a clear shot from the stairwell to the end of the corridor. I know it took no longer than a few seconds for me to make it down the hall, through the door, and up the stairs, but in the adrenaline-induced state it had all shifted into a hazed torpor. All I remember was yanking the door open to the first floor with a shotgun ready. My father had trained me. He was a precise and persistent shooting instructor who started teaching me when I was 5. Most people are self-taught. They don't shoot enough to acquire skill or even become used to handling guns. They stand wrong, hold their heads wrong, and even close one eye when they sight, thus cutting down vision and handicapping themselves in their ability to judge distance. 35 yards. I clicked the safety off. "Sheriff's Department, freeze!" Only his head turned to me. His hands remained on the knob. He smiled with horrible teeth and drew his shoulder back. I knew that I would make the shot. Just as I was sure that there was a .38 caliber revolver waiting on the other side of that door that was being held in a two-handed standing position by a steady hand with a set of beautifully manicured nails. At 35 yards, the 12-gauge would more than hurt him, but at 8 feet, the .38 would kill him. It wasn't that I minded Leo dead all that much, but I didn't want Katie to do it. As his shoulder came forward, so did mine, and I fired. Contrary to popular belief, even the most powerful of modern loads and weapons only caused the target to slump and fall. Leo's attempt to push the door open was converted into an assisted collapse into the door jamb, where his knees buckled for a moment. He straightened as he turned to glare at me. "Sheriff's Department, don't move!" He did, of course, and transferred his weight into a galloping retreat down the corridor, one foot slightly dragged behind the other in his attempt to get away. I pushed off and started to pursue him. He was moving fast, especially for a man with a couple of extra ounces of lead in him. There were fire exits at the end of the hallways at Durant Memorial, but he turned the corner leading to the front entrance and disappeared in the direction of the desk and Ruby. I am not the fastest man in Absaroka County. I knew I wasn't even the fastest man in the hospital right now, but I was going to have to do. I tried to make the corner at the entryway and bounced off the far wall in time to see the pneumatic doors at the front of the hospital slowly close. Ruby was standing at the reception desk, waving me on as I approached. "Go! Go!" I slammed through the two sets of doors and onto the sidewalk. Surely they had heard the shotgun up on the second floor. I was going to need backup. He had changed direction and was running the length of the hospital toward the snow-covered golf course and the town park that were located beyond the drifts that had been plowed against the parking lot's chain-link fence. 60 yards, and I was keeping pace. The air was cold, and each step felt as if I were pushing a car. I cursed my laziness at not running for the last few weeks, but watched with satisfaction as Leo slipped on the man-sized mountains of plowed snow and crashed into the fence. I started to bring the shotgun up, but incredibly his hands clutched the twisted top of the railing, and he threw himself over and into the darkness beyond. I was convinced he wasn't human. I knew I had to gain all the momentum I could between here and there, so I lengthened my stride and pushed the car harder. The frozen crust held just long enough for me to use it as a ramp. I calculated my options, threw the Remington over the fence, and hit the top rail at about my hips. The continued momentum carried me over head first, flipping me and depositing me flat on my back onto the cushioning snow below. I forced the air into my lungs, lurched up into a sitting position, and searched for the shotgun. I couldn't find it. I looked up to see Leo Gaskell making time as I scrambled onto my knees and looked for any disturbance in the snow that might indicate where my only weapon might be. Nothing. It was a dreadful decision, but the only one that made sense if I was going to catch him. I rolled to one side, pushed off with my back leg, and started after him, unarmed. I could still see him in the distance as the moon struggled through the cloud cover and the branches of the huge conifers that surrounded the Ninth Green and the Clear Creek Reservoir, where an awful lot of golfers lost their balls. The snow was almost to our knees, but his long legs made progress like some crazy post-hole tamper. Methamphetamines, had to be. There was a gradual decline, which led to a flat and a few deciduous trees before you got to what looked like a break in the fence and the creek beyond. He just didn't seem to be slowing, whereas my second and third wind seemed to be going the way of the first. My lungs felt like they were going to explode, but I could hear something coming up on my left. It was Sizar Vittoria, and he passed me. His knees pumped above the snow like Leo's, and I could see the Beretta 9mm in his left hand and the bare soles of his feet flashing back at me as he pulled away. It didn't take long for him to get far ahead of me, but after a few more strides, I discovered that I could keep pace by running in Sancho's naked footprints. His stride was only a little shorter than mine, and I gained speed going down the hill. Just as he got to the flat area, Leo disappeared through the sagging part of the fence. In the spears of moonlight, I could see where the bank dropped off down to another level area where the wind had pushed the snow pack from the reflective surface of the ice on Clear Creek. I saw Sizar Vittoria charge through the fence, through the trees, and he too was gone. By the time I got to the flat, lumbered through the fence, and bounced off one of the trees, I could see them struggling at the creek bank. The elongated, stalk-like shadow of Leo Gaskell struck Sizar Vittoria with a hammering roundhouse blow, and I watched as my deputy slumped and Leo lifted him to slug him again. Up until this moment, my size and weight had worked against me, but with only 30 feet to go, I put everything I had into Leo. He was just turning as I hit him with all the accumulated speed of the last 5 minutes. We carried Sizar Vittoria with us as we went. I felt the breath go out of Leo as we flew over and out onto the middle of the creek. The three of us landed with a shuddering thud as the surface of the ice indented with a resonating sound that carried vibrations across the surface through Leo Gaskell, Sancho, and into me. Almost immediately, the ice shattered and dropped us into the freezing water that traveled swiftly beneath the surface. Sancho wasn't moving, and I could feel he was under us and was dropping faster as the edge of the ice crumbled from underneath. I closed one hand around Leo's struggling shoulders and clasped the hood of his insulated coveralls with the other, the quick popping noise telling me it had detached from the rest of him. He lurched sideways in an attempt to free himself of me, but I held on with one hand and dragged him back to the black water behind us. I threw the hood away and slapped a hand on Sancho as the current yanked at his legs. I could feel Leo wrench away from me again. He was a monster. His huge shoulders and chest were disproportionate in comparison with his lean waist and limbs, and his head seemed like some block teetering out on the end of his stem-like neck. If my suspicions were correct, Leo Gaskell suffered from lack of appetite, insomnia, exceedingly high blood pressure, palpitations, and cyanosis, with cerebral hemorrhage next on the list, but right now, he was just strong as an ox. There were fissures in the surrounding ice, and the thumping of the trapped air and water was as loud as our struggling. I could see large chunks of the ice breaking apart where Sancho was sinking. I tightened my grip and tried to drag him toward me, but Leo took advantage of my brief distraction to twist sideways again and bring his booted foot up and into my face. I heard the surprising crack and grinding of broken bone. I tried to stretch my facial muscles to check the damage, but nothing felt as if it were moving. I couldn't hang on to Sancho and Leo. Leo slipped my grasp, getting half his body onto the thicker ice at the edge of the creek, and he watched as the ice surrounding Sizer Vittoria and me broke off with the sound of pistol shots. The last thing I saw of Leo Gaskell, with my one eye, he was smiling, showing those twisted and rotting teeth. There wasn't a lot of time to prepare for the effects of the water, and maybe that was a blessing. There's a tingling and a high itch that shrieks in the back of your head when you hit water this cold. Probably some kind of alarm that's telling your body that this is a really bad idea. All I could think to do was keep a hold on Sancho's jacket as I felt him slip down with me. I couldn't feel the bottom, and the ridge of ice around us was breaking away in handfuls. My legs went along with the current, pushing against the undersurface and giving me just enough leverage to shove Sancho's chest up and onto the ice. I turned my head sideways, trying to get the rest of Sizer Vittoria's unconscious body out of the water, and it was then that the ledge I was hanging on to completely let go. I released Sancho so that he would not be dragged under with me and scrambled with both hands to get another grip on the broken lip of the ice, but it was too late. I was cognizant enough to draw a deep breath as the ice broke beneath me. The sweeping current of Clear Creek yanked me below as my one eye looked for the surface by following the bubbles as they swirled away from me and began a stately rise to the air above. Paisleys of plum and electric green and the stark white of the moon reflected in the world I had come from. I hoped that I had gotten Sizer Vittoria far enough up so that he wouldn't be pulled under as well. I was bleeding adrenaline, and the areas of unprotected skin were now absolutely numb. There were shadowy, echoing sounds that approached from all directions. With a sudden exertion, I slapped my hands against the smooth facade of the underside of the ice as part of my remaining air escaped with a faint rumbling noise that matched the thumping of my hands against the hard surface. The one eye was still functioning, so I strained to see the bubbles, but the view was distorted and confusing, and I continued to feel as if I were falling backward. The weight of my head pivoted me to the side, and my arms trailed out behind me. I frantically tried to right myself and turn back, but my arms wouldn't move, and my fingers felt motionless. The dull glow of the surface didn't appear from above, but seemed to radiate all around me. Somehow, it was lighter now, and I could just see that the bottom of the creek was scattered with broken tree limbs and large stones. Everything seemed to glow with a pale light with no shadow, and grand sweeps of bubbles stood still in the frozen water with deep cracks that shone like knife blades. The back of my head hit something hard as I moved along, and a little more air escaped. I could taste a small amount of blood in my mouth, and my head was yanked down with the current, and a sharp pain lingered in my side. There was a continuous thumping, but it was more rhythmical than before, and was now accompanied by a continuous baritone that pressed painfully against my ears. The vertigo caused by the current had subsided to a dull ache of inverted velocity. The uniform horizon had shifted from green to an almost impenetrable black, and the only thing I could hear was the sound of the drums that pounded my skull against what felt like solid rock. With all the energy I had left, I pivoted to one side and tried to break free from whatever was holding me. I tried to drive my elbow into the ice above as the current knocked me back and forth. I shifted, this time keeping the movement more compact and not allowing the water to rob me of momentum. A resounding thump, and then nothing. The bleeding adrenaline staunched, and air was now the issue. I slammed my hand against the ice this time, and the sound reverberated along with the drums. Shadows moved in the dull glow of the surface as I flailed against it with wooden fingers. I stretched my arms out in an attempt to widen my hunt and searched for any opening, but there was none. I almost laughed when the shadows appeared above me, and there was a strident sound, a shrieking din that sounded like the warbling pitch of Cheyenne Plainsong. And I must have been hallucinating, because it seemed as if a huge blade had knifed through the thickness of the ice. I fumbled a hand toward it, but it disappeared, and the pressure in my lungs built to the point of explosion. I felt my diaphragm tense as it prepared to blow my lungs clear of my last breath. I held it for a few seconds more, just as the broad blade of something like an axe appeared again. They say that your life passes before your eyes, but that's not what happens. What happens is that you think of all the things you didn't get done. Big things, small things, all the things that are left. I exhaled, and immediately drew in two lungs full of frozen water. There were still sounds, the echoing thump of the drums and the shrieking din of the discordant song, but they slowly faded as I wavered there in the current. The pressure pulled my chin down to my chest, and I noticed a white, round speck lodged against the dark mud at the banks of Clear Creek, just before the rushing eddies rocked me into the black. How is my English? Her voice came from the right and was slightly behind me. I dipped my head and looked under my arm to see a beautiful pair of naked, suntanned feet. She was standing in the same swales of buffalo grass as she had before. I turned to look at her. Good. Better than my Basque. She was gorgeous and was wearing what she always wore in my dreams, a flowing summer dress with small white dots on a dark background. The breeze drifted from the mountains and pushed the chiffon against her legs, and the sun glowed warm against the bighorns. She was petite, and my first instinct was to place my hand at the small of her back and lift her up so that I could get a closer look at the perfect face hidden in the swirl of dark hair. She reached a hand out, then let it drop in resignation, and glanced toward the ridges of the canyon above. I followed her eyes and noticed that clouds had gathered